Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in West Lafayette, Indiana, and earned a bachelor's degree in biology from Purdue and a doctor of medicine from Vanderbilt. From 2004 to 2015, he held various executive leadership roles with Summa Health. And since 2018, he's been the president of Ascension Michigan, which consists of 18 facilities, 23,000 plus staff, and sees over 600,000 patients each year. His name, Dr. Ken Berkovitz. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the president of Ascension Michigan, Dr. Ken Berkovitz. Doctor, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. It's great to be here.
Can you talk about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Sure. I had a blessed childhood. My mom and my dad met on a blind date. My mom was a refugee from World War II, and she emigrated from Hungary right after the end of the Second World War and settled in Los Angeles. And then she met my father, who was at that time a postdoctorate fellow in mathematics at the Rand Corporation. They got married, and then in the early 1960s, my father took our family to West Lafayette, Indiana, where he remained for the remainder of his career as a professor of mathematics at Purdue University. My mom then went on to be in the biology department and also as a professor of biology. And she had two children, my older brother, who's an attorney in Washington, D.C., and myself, who turned out to be the physician in the family.
And you wanted to be Rick Mount when you were a young kid, huh?
I did. I have Rick Mount's autograph.
Okay. What's the biggest thing mom taught you, doctor? And what's the biggest thing dad taught you?
I would say my parents probably both really stressed education, and they really had a hope that both their children would go into medicine and be doctors. But really what they wanted us to do is to have a good education. They thought that that was the foundation for a lot of opportunity and success in the business world and in life. And so both of them really, really stressed the need for education. And in fact, my father, as I was going along in my journey as a physician, as you know, after medical school, you're not done. And there can be lots and lots of training. And many of us are tired of it being in training. And my father encouraged me to spend extra time getting the extra training that I might need in advanced fellowships and things of that nature so that I could do things that I really enjoyed for the next 20, 30 years of my career. So that was really good advice that I have continued to pass along to residents.
Speaking of a good education, Purdue and Vanderbilt are two special universities. Why so?
Well, Purdue was a special place for me because I grew up in West Lafayette, Indiana, which is really a college town. And so everything focuses around Purdue. And my classmates in school, in elementary school, middle school, and high school, 80, 90% of them, their parents worked at Purdue University. So our lives were very much entwined around Purdue. And so it was very natural. It was also very inexpensive for me to go to Purdue as an undergraduate. And obviously they have many, many strong departments, especially in the sciences and in engineering, as well as business. And then I was fortunate to go to Vanderbilt, which was a really wonderful experience for me. We had a very small medical school class. There were 106 people in my medical school class. And the faculty at the medical school really took very good care of us, and they were really committed to our education and getting us on the right track as young students and as young physicians. And Vanderbilt really was a very rigorous academic school, and they really, it was very interesting. I was fortunate to get in. I don't know how I got in, because all my other classmates were really very, very bright students from all around the country, but really it attracts the best and the brightest of from the Southern United States. And my first days there, I go, God, the way these people talk, I know I'm much smarter than they are, but I certainly learned after the first series of exams that indeed was not the case, that they were all much smarter than me.
How was it you decided the profession of being a doctor?
Well, you know, I think my parents always held the position in as a physician in high regard. And so I think they encouraged both myself and my brother to go into medicine. And I was attracted by it, both by the intellectual aspect of it. There's so much to learn, and learning is lifelong and continuous. So it's always an intellectual challenge. And then the real thing was, it was an opportunity to help people, especially in great times of need. And that's something that I still think to this day that makes it the best profession possible, is that it's a real privilege and responsibility to be invited into people's lives at sometimes the most vulnerable times that people can have. So it's a real great opportunity and joy for me.
We're talking to Dr. Ken Berkovitz, who started to practice in 1991. When we come back, we're going to ask him, why did he go from cardiology to health administration? And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Well, what had led up to that was I had served as president of the medical staff of Akron City Hospital. And during my years, both leading up to the presidency and then the post-president role, I was really exposed to a lot of the issues that affect physicians and patients. And so I was really interested by the challenge of some of the more macro issues around healthcare, is how do we allocate resources? How do we build programs? How do we develop a culture, especially around hospitality? How do we have foster a culture of excellence so that those who come to our organization have the best opportunity for a great experience and a great outcome? And really, it was an exposure to all the things that go on before and after I would see a patient in my office. And so and all that work really intrigued me. And it was a very complex, intricate environment. I thought that work could benefit from having someone who had a significant clinical background.
From 2004 to 2015, you held various executive leadership roles with Summa Health. Talk about that chapter in your life.
Well, that was a very interesting chapter in my life, because we were raising three kids at the time, and I actually held two half-time positions. I was half-time a department chairman of the Department of Cardiovascular Disease and service line lead for the cardiovascular health service line for this Summa Health System, and I was also a practicing interventional cardiologist. And on paper, I was supposed to be half-time each. And in reality, I probably was close to full-time each. So It was a busy number of years for me between having a full-time practice. I was an interventional cardiologist when I practiced medicine, so I was on call about every third night, frequently going into the hospital for emergencies, then having to do quite a bit of clinical work as well as my administrative responsibilities around the cardiovascular disease department. That said, both of those things were incredibly rewarding for me. Both my personal practice and the practice of our group grew in that decade plus of time. We got a number of national recognitions as being recognized at U.S. News and World Report top 50 hospitals. So we felt really good about the work that we were doing as clinicians. We were building a lot of great programs. We were adding to our educational war chest. We started a cardiology fellowship, which allowed us to train future physicians. And many of our physicians found that rejuvenating to their career, the chance to educate and be around young, inquisitive minds was rejuvenating for us who had gotten, bogged down in the routine of clinical practice. So we did a lot of great things in those times, and I certainly learned a lot, both in the practice of clinical cardiology, as well as in the tools of the trade around leadership and administration.
From 2015 to 2018, you were the CEO of the Cardiovascular Institute at OSF Healthcare System. Talk about that chapter.
Well, that was an interesting chapter in my life, and I should say the transition really began when we started a new clinical program called TAVR, which is a way to replace the aortic valve and do it without a major surgery. We could now do it through a small incision in the groin, like we do heart catheterization. And so that revolutionized the procedure. But when that procedure rolled out, it required a team of physicians and building that team of physicians, building the clinics to see the patients, and then also not only building a new catheterization laboratory to do the procedures, but getting the funding to do that. And that was a really a large undertaking, and it took us about a year to get that program up and running. And I had the fortune to help lead that. And then I also had the privilege of being one of the first physicians to do the procedure. And then I realized at that time that I enjoyed building the program more than I did doing the procedures. And so that was a sign to me that maybe I should change the trajectory of my career. And I started to focus more on developing my leadership and administrative role. And our youngest child at that time was a senior in high school. And someone reached out to me and said there was an opportunity to go to Illinois and really to lead a wonderful program that was kind of bigger in scale and had more scope and more responsibility. So after much hand-wringing and discussion with family and friends, after being in Akron for over 22 years, we decided to make the jump and move to Illinois. It was also an opportunity for me to develop my leadership skills in a new environment and in a place where people didn't know me as a clinical cardiologist, where they didn't know me as their clinical cardiologist, that I hadn't taken care of family members of the board or family members of administration or other colleagues? And could I be as influential just as an administrator and not as a cardiologist and also people's of influence cardiologist? So it was really a new test for me, and it was a new start. And it was really a wonderful 3 years that we had in Central Illinois.
They came to love you. And then in 2018, you decide to join Ascension in Michigan. Moved to Grosse Pointe from Peoria. Huge change. Why did you do that?
Well, when we got to Illinois, I, like I said, it was a leadership challenge to me, and I didn't know how well I would do with it. And I got the sense that I was doing okay. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being on a little bit bigger stage. And the other thing that I really enjoyed was this was my first exposure to Catholic healthcare. And one of the things that's really special about Catholic healthcare is the commitment to the care of the poor and the most vulnerable. And that was really incredibly refreshing and rewarding for me. Oftentimes, medicine feels a little bit too much like a business. And to get back in that environment where there was laser focus on the mission and the importance of the mission really opened my eyes and gave me a tremendous amount of energy. So I began to want to look for maybe yet a bigger stage to display my leadership skills and my leadership passion. And I was contacted by a colleague that there was an opportunity to lead the medical group at Ascension Michigan. And so that really was, it fulfilled two out of the three things that I was looking for. Number one wanted to stay in Catholic healthcare because of this commitment to the mission. Number two was it was an opportunity to lead a group outside of just cardiovascular medicine to expand my experience and opportunities. So those were the two things where I executed on. The third thing that we missed on is the last 10 years, our family's been trying to move to warmer weather. And so we didn't hit on that one.
We're talking to Dr. Ken Berkovitz, who works for Ascension Michigan. And the parent company, Ascension, is the largest nonprofit and Catholic health system in America. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Dr. Ken Berkovitz, the president of Ascension Michigan. Doctor, tell us about Ascension Michigan, please.
Ascension Michigan is a very large organization within a even larger national organization, Ascension Healthcare. Ascension Michigan comprised of 15 hospitals. We have over 200 sites of care throughout the state of Michigan. We have approximately 25,000 employed associates throughout the state. We have sizes ranging from 700-bed tertiary care hospitals to 20-bed critical access hospitals in our more rural settings. We have urban hospitals, we have suburban hospitals, and we have hospitals in between. So we have we have a little bit of everything within Ascension Michigan, and I think it's this heterogeneity of all that we have that really is kind of part of our secret sauce in what makes us great. So we have a little bit of everything, and we have to be good at it all.
All right. A lot of us were raised by the nuns with the rulers, et cetera, et cetera. What's it like working for the nuns?
Well, when I went to OSF Healthcare, our nuns it was a Franciscan order, and they came routinely in their brown habits, and it was absolutely delightful to work for the sisters. They were very kind, very generous. They had their rules. And And they were, and you knew exactly what to expect from them. They were very appreciative of the work, and they made it clear that our objectives were to provide care for everybody, the best care for everybody, with excellent outcomes, but most importantly, the human element of serving people with care and serving people with love. And it was just a very refreshing experience. We spent a great deal of time with the sisters, both in the they were very involved in the actual administration and operations of our facilities, as well as they were very interested in our spiritual and emotional development, and the sisters were very intentional about spending time with us to help us in that journey.
Let's go back 13 months, right around March 12th, 2020, and COVID shutdown hits. What's amazed you the most these past 13 months, Doctor?
So I should say for the audience, I transitioned into the president role 3 weeks before, I would say, the start of COVID. What has impressed me the most is how our associates have ran to the fire, and the courage and the competence of our associates I use this word infrequently, is truly humbling to be around. It's really an honor to serve alongside our associates. People were volunteering to come serve in very scary times, in uncertain times. We didn't know at all what we were dealing with in early on. We knew our associates knew that their work was a risk to their own health and potentially a risk to their own families, but yet they showed up. They volunteered. They took extra shifts. They worked wherever they needed to work. We had people doing things that they hadn't done in quite some time. Received emergency training on certain things, and again, volunteering courageously, coming to work every day, staying late. And again, you know, it was a time when visitors weren't allowed, and so they were not only were they caregivers, but they were the source of love and emotion to those who were by themselves in the hospital. So just it was just an amazing show of competence and compassion.
You mentioned that they ran to the fire. The job that these nurses and doctors have done in the world is like the firemen on 9/11 going up those twin towers, huh? It's amazing. You didn't have the equipment, you know, the ventilators, et cetera, and all this unknown. Phenomenal what they did.
I couldn't agree more. And you know, it was not only our doctors and our nurses, but so much of the other support staff, environmental services, food services, our biomedical engineering, everybody was in there. And as you said, it was very much like 9/11, but what was different is this went on for days and weeks and months, and people still kept coming. They still ran to the fire. And in fact, you know, one of the things that was really tremendous about us being part of a national organization is we even had our nurses come in from Texas and Florida and Kansas. Because as you remember, in Michigan, we were surging, especially in Southeast Michigan, At one time, we were third or fourth in the country in the number of cases. And our other facilities at the time weren't seeing the volume of COVID cases. And so these people flew up here and spent a month with us to help manage all this business. So it was really just, it was really great to see not only within Ascension, Michigan, but really with the whole Ascension family chipping in to help us out.
You've been around a lot of doctors in your life. What do all great doctors have in common?
That's a really good question. And what I would say is, one of my favorite sayings is, patients don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And what I will say is the great doctors all have a ability to empathize and care about their patients, and they're able to communicate that in a way that their patients know that the person in front of them really cares about them, and that the person in front of them is really special to them, and they're not just a number. They're somebody who's really very dearly important to them. So it's really about really showing their love for those who are under their care.
Talk about showing their love, a ministry of love. Don't tell me how much you know until you show me how much you care. Yeah. That's the definition of a nurse today. Talk about the job these nurses do every day, day in and day out.
Nursing is certainly a very rewarding profession. Because you do get to care and minister to the sick, but boy, it is a hard job. And in the best of times, it's a hard job. We have lots of patients. Our patients are getting older. They're getting sicker. They're getting more complex in their diseases. The social challenges that affect the patients, all those things. Patients bring a lot with them when they come to us now. And then you throw on a pandemic where not only do the nurses have to do their usual work, but there's no family there at these patients' bedside because they can't come into the hospital because of our COVID restrictions. And so they have to not only do their normal care for our emotional patients, but they also have to substitute in some ways or as best as possible to be there emotionally because families can't be at our patient's side. I mean, just think about when we've been ill. I think most of us have been blessed to have a loved one or a friend with us at some point in our illness and in our journey, especially when we're hospitalized. But during COVID, that wasn't possible. And so also it was the emotional toll was really, really quite dramatic on our nursing staff because they were there, they were in the room and they were at the bedside when our patients, unfortunately, we lost a lot of patients during this pandemic and they were there providing the care, the emotional support as a nurse and kind of acting as also emotional support as a surrogate family member. So just a tremendous job.
We're talking to Dr. Ken Berkovitz. If you want to learn more, www.healthcare.ascension.org. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Jack Rasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol.
Anything is possible.
I'm Jack Vasula. This is Anything is Possible. And we're talking to the president of Ascension Michigan, Dr. Ken Berkovitz. Doctor, independent of which party gets credits, from a standing start in April of 2020, today we have about 140 million vaccines administered. Talk to us about that feat.
It is nothing short of amazing. And I did a poll of my executive team in July of last year. And I asked them, when will we have a vaccine? And I gave them the end of December 2020, July 21, December 21, or sometime in 22. None of my leadership team, myself included, voted that we would have a vaccine by the end of the year. We had shots in arms in December of 2020. And we were hoping that the vaccine would be 40% effective, maybe if we were really lucky, 50% effective. And these vaccines are, we can argue what the number is, but it's probably over 90% effective. And even more importantly, these vaccines are even higher in their effectiveness with the most important thing, which is reducing serious illness, hospitalization, and death. And really what you want to avoid is serious illness and death. And these vaccines are incredibly effective. And all three of the vaccines that are out there now appear to be, as best I can tell, equally effective in preventing serious illness and death. And they're really good at it. So the fact that we even had any of these things by the end of the year last year is just is really a medical miracle. And we got off to a little bit of a uncoordinated start in the rollout of the vaccines, but we are really rolling right now. And we're doing 2-3 million Americans a day in vaccination. It is a real testament to modern medicine. And there are a lot of people who should share credit in that. But the engine is really humming now. And if you would have told me that we would have had over 100 million people vaccinated by April 1st, or 140 or 150 million, you would have told me that a year ago today, I would have laughed at you.
All right. What do you say to a person tonight that says, Doc, I'm afraid to get it, or there's something in it that Bill Gates has got that they're going to know? You know, all of these theories. What do you say to that person tonight?
We should hear their concerns. We should understand what's on their mind. When a patient presents to me with reluctance, I assure them that when I was eligible, I got a vaccine, and my family, when they are eligible, I will have them in line for the vaccine. I will tell them that it is my strong belief as a physician and someone who's been in this business for over 30 years that the benefits of this vaccine far outweigh the risk of the vaccine. I would tell them that not only does a vaccine protect you from infection, but I think it protects your neighbor, your family, your friends, and your relatives from infection. And then the next thing that I don't think is getting enough discussion is we hear a lot about these variants of these new virus variants that are coming out. And that's something that really should be expected, because these viruses are machines, And as part of their mechanism for survival, they have mutations at when they reproduce. And part of that is fighting natural selection. So they mutate in order to survive. And the problem is some of these new mutations may become refractory or not responsive to our current treatment. So we may get a mutation in the future that our current vaccines don't provide immunity against. And so the way to prevent new strains of the virus coming out is to reduce the number of mutations. And the way to reduce the number of mutations is to reduce the number of infections. So the more people who get the vaccination now, the less chance the virus has to mutate and become refractory to treatment. It's possible that a new strain of this could reinfect us down the road. So our best hope for that is that we get vaccinated and our neighbors get vaccinated as well. So, you know, my belief is it's about doing something to protect yourself. But I think an even bigger thing is it's part of what it is. It means to be part of community. And I think that is something that's spoken about in the Bible. And our obligations to our community. So I think we need to think about it in those terms. And there's no funny business going on with these vaccines. I am totally convinced there's no nothing nefarious or anything bad associated with the development or the injection of these agents.
What will healthcare, how will it change in the next 10 years, Doc?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think I do a lot of reading on this, and I think one of the best things that I think summaries that I've thought that I've read on this is people have said that COVID may not have changed some of the things that are coming, but it probably accelerated a lot of the things that are coming. So, for example, virtual medicine or telemedicine, there are ways for us to take care of people virtually now. It's much more convenient, and so I think that probably would have happened on its own, but we were forced to get exposed to virtual medicine and telemedicine when we were shut down for 3 months, and so doctors got used to it, patients got used to it. And not only did they get used to it, they kind of liked it. They could get together on times that are mutually acceptable. They don't have to drive to the office. They don't have to wait for an appointment. Sometimes it's easier just to do it over the phone. Similar to how we have Zoom meetings. Sometimes it's nicer just to see somebody over a Zoom call rather than drive 45 minutes for a meeting and then drive an hour and a half back because you're caught in traffic and saves a little bit of time. So things like that will accelerate. I think the other thing that will change in healthcare, and I hope it changes in healthcare, is the pandemic really shined a light on the disparities of care that we have in America, and that the poor and vulnerable communities were struck much harder by COVID than wealthier communities. And why is that? And it really shows that you know, not only are some people have financial challenge, but it's affecting their health. And we need to think. And so I think this is going to help us refocus on that and figure out what are the strategies to improve the health of communities, especially in the underserved areas.
Dr. Ken Berkowitz, thanks a million for the fantastic job you and your 25,000 teammates at Ascension Michigan have done during this COVID this past 13 months. Please keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.
Believe in yourself.